Accession number 18463, reel 35.
Dunbarret reel 35.
Anyway, the morning is reasonably normal until about 1000 hours when word comes that there's going to be an airdrop on the Canadians, who apparently are cut off. And the three aircraft then, three big box cars, fly out over the Canadian position, circle right the way around us, and come back, and they start dropping their supplies in the valley, a little valley on our left-hand side. They've missed the Canadians, and they're dropping their load on us, although apparently other aircraft did drop right on the Canadian position, but this lot's missed us. And it's we've never had an airdrop before in our battalion area. And they're all different colour parachutes coming down. And down with them, they must, I don't know whether they throw them out or whether they're in the parachutes, but little messages, little paper messages saying that whatever you do, don't damage the parachutes and send them back because your buddies will need them in the future. That moment, looking behind us, I can see an Australian company coming up the ridge behind us, coming up from the road and up the ridge. And a message comes over the radio that we're moving out and the Aussies are taking over our position, because the expectation is that the Chinese are moving around the flank and are going to attack down where the guns and Brigade HQ are. Anyway, the Aussies come up, but of course they ignore completely these little bits of paper fluttering down, and they hope they got rations down there, so they're down in the valley, rushing down and cutting off the parachutes to put in their slit trenches, and we could hear them cursing and swearing because most of it's ammunition, there's no rations, which is what they wanted. But we're moving out by this time, and they're taking over. But they're at full strength, you'll appreciate, you know, so they are always at full strength, because if they have any casualties, they fly them in the next day, or the company that's taken over us at full strength. And although they've had quite a, you know, 70 or 80 casualties overnight. And we go down onto the road, form up on the road, and there are tanks on the road now. I think they were 5th Cavalry tanks, and they're going to go forward, apparently, and check out where the what's happening down where the Australians are withdrawn from, and presumably the Aussies will send a company down with them to bring out their dead and what have you, because they've had to abandon their dead up there and any equipment that's left up there. Anyway, we're not concerned with this. We're off down the road, and I don't know how far we went, 2 or 3 miles, something like that. And we veered off into a flat area of paddy fields, and we dig in the paddy. Major Allen gives me my position, and I had quite a good position, in actual fact, covering the road, and of course the river as well. And we found a little Will and I found a little hollow, and we dug a trench in the bottom of the hollow, and then I could literally use the brink of this hollow to sort of keep observation all around the platoon area. But there's only 20 of us, so I mean we're fairly sparsely spread out. And this company HQ is just behind us, and then the other two platoons are spread out in a more or less an arc around there in a reasonably flat area. And looking back down the road, south down the road, we can see Brigade HQ and a few sand-coloured tents. I think this was probably 28th Brigade HQ, because it didn't look quite the same as ours. There was just a couple of vehicles and these sand-coloured tents, which we hadn't seen before. A bit farther down the road, we can hear the guns are back down there, but they've ceased firing now. The battle's more or less stopped, and we're waiting for a new attack. We spend quite a good night here, very comfortably night. And of course the company commander always does his rounds, so you must keep alert all the time. And Will and I do our, I'm holding the headset and, a handset rather, and he's got the headset on, so it works out quite well. Unfortunately, of course, he's not getting any real rest at all, which is a great pity. because he deserves it. And it's quite night. Following morning, I guess 1000 maybe. It could have been earlier, could have been 800. I'm looking out down the road, and the Australians start to come past us. So they're obviously evacuating their position and moving back. And I whipped over to the company commander and said, the Australians are withdrawing, sir. And he said, I wouldn't let them hear you saying that, Corporal, because I don't think they're very pleased to hear you say withdrawing. And I said, well, you know, it was just a term. They're passing by then on the end of the road there. And he watched them through the glasses for a while. And it was obvious to us then that brigade was withdrawing. And presumably 5th Cav were taking over. And we were going back off down the road. Not long after that, we withdrew down onto the road. And we only needed one lorry, of course. So there was a lorry for 6th Platoon there, and all the lads got up at the top, and I thought, oh golly, I've got to sit in the front. I hate in the front of a vehicle because you're so encapsulated and you can't see around you. Just about to climb up with the driver and a young second lieutenant who I knew and he knew me came back and said, only officers drive in the front of the vehicles, Corporal Barrett, you should know that by now. And he climbs up into the cab of the vehicle, and unfortunately my lads are feeling a bit miffed about this, and they're saying some rude words very out loud about him and what have you, and I give him a little bit of a rocket, because you can't have that, you know, even if it is a silly young man, you can't have that. Anyway, we drive off. Unfortunately it rained, of course. It always seems to rain when you're in the backs of these vehicles, and we got fairly damp. Drove on past the 16th field. 16th field have gone, incidentally. They've moved out by this time. And there was the biggest heap of empty metal cases which the shells come in. I'd never seen anything like it in all my life. I mean, I suppose it was 50 yards. I think it's 100 yards long, but I really couldn't say. And it was higher than a house, and I mean an English house, not a traditional Korean house. It was an enormous grave. I can't imagine how they ever got the cases up to the top there. But I guess 10,000 rounds would make a fair heap. Pass on down, past them, and eventually at dusk, we've probably been travelling for about 8 or 9 hours, something like that, I guess. And at dusk, we stop. The vehicles stop on the side of the road. And company commander calls an O group. It's dark this time. It gets dark very, very quickly in the east. And gives us their orders. He said, we're just getting off the road for the night, digging in a defensive position. And we'll be moving on at first light the following morning. Anyway, he leads off with head of 4 platoon. They're entering into a very black looking gully. We're having to force our way through chest high foliage. We lead on down through there, and it opens out a little bit on the other side of this with a little mound. So he puts company HQ on the mound and then sends the platoons off. I know 5 went to the left and 4 went forward and to the left a bit, and he said to me, dig up on this, get up on the top of that hill there and dig in up there. And it was nearly vertical. So I got the lads and lined them up. They don't make a very good long line, 20 of them. And we started to climb up the side of this hill. It was very, very difficult. I mean, we were on hands and knees. It's that sort of difficult. And came up, and there was a little sort of ridge. So we had a little bit of a rest there. And they're not too pleased, the lads, now, because you know it's not a very good position, obviously. So I sort of, Bill and I force them on to up another thing. There's another little ridge, and we're getting pretty exhausted by this time, and of course soaked with perspiration. So I said to Bill, well, let's leave them here, and we'll go and see where the top of this wretched thing is, because that's where we want to dig in. Anyway, we climbed up, I don't know, another 50 or 60 feet, I guess. And it's still sheer. We're clambering up on our hands and knees, pulling ourselves up by, well, grass this time, because there's no bushes on this wretched hill. which were to give you a handhold to pull you up, get up to about another 50 feet, I guess. And Bill's exhausted, I can see. So I said to him, you hang on here, and I'll go up and see if I can find the top. Anyway, I went on about another 50 feet, and it began to ease off a little bit, but not very much. So went back to Bill and we had a little chat, and I said, well, it's no good. I'll have to pluck up my courage and go and see the company commander and say, look, there's no way we can dig on the side of this hill. It's absolutely impossible. And I wasn't feeling very happy at doing that, because, you know, it's your first chance as a platoon commander. Anyway, I went down and saw him and said to him, I'm sorry, sir, but we just cannot dig in. We just got to hang on by our bootlaces and try and hang on the side of the hill. He said, right, well, bring them down and dig them in on the end of where my platoon HQ was, which surprised me somewhat, because I thought I was going to get a bit of a telling off. Anyway, I went back up to them again, and we literally slid down on our backs. You just had to slide down the side of this hill, and it was a very soft dig. We dug in, and we were very fortunate because we were right by company HQ, and they'd got a little burner going there, so we had a hot tin of rations and a cup of hot water for coffee. The night's quiet, nothing happens. Following morning at stand two, looking around, we're literally in a bowl, enormous great hills all the way around us, and you've got that feeling that there are people up there looking down. I'm sure there's nobody up there, but you've got that feeling that people are looking down at you. And when I see what was my hill, I realise now that if I'd gone on perhaps another 50 or 60 feet, there was an actual crest. So I thought to myself, I bet Major Allen's thinking to himself, oh dear, I can't trust this guy. Anyway, we go back to the road, get on the vehicles, and naturally it rains again shortly after that. And it gets pretty steady now. We drive all day, virtually. And I can't remember what time we got in the afternoon, but we stopped off. The vehicles left us now, dumped us on the side of the road. And we climb up this hill again, and another hill, they're all hills, Greer. And the company commander puts me in a position in amongst some trees, incidentally, which are bushes, which, you know, small trees, on the edge of the road, overlooking the road. And I got the feeling that he probably put me in a position where he could perhaps keep an eye on me, you know, because it's been a natural thing to do. So I'm overlooking the road amongst these trees. And he came over and said, I'm sending the MFC, mortifier controller, over with you, and sort of add to your numbers a little bit. And we're digging in. But unfortunately, the rain stopped, but we're under the trees, and every time you knock a tree, you get soaked again, and we're absolutely soaked to the skin. But we dug in down through the roots and what have you, and got quite a good position. Will and I are back on off the road a little bit, because we want to keep an eye out to company HQ and cover the entrance into our position. We're doing quite well, got down there, had our rations, and company HQ have got a heater up again, and are boiling up some water and hot food, so we can throw a tin in. The old system is, you throw a tin in that you don't like, and you take out a tin, and that's probably one that somebody else didn't like, but it's hot anyway, and a cup of water to mix your coffee in. And late in the evening, before stand two, company commander came over, and I've never seen him smile before, but he's sort of grinning a little bit, and he said, I've got three recruits for you, and he's got three New Zealanders. And I said, what were they doing then? He said, they want to see the war, so I brought them over to you. Could you get them dug in your perimeter somewhere? And I said, well, yeah, I can do. And he goes on sort of smiling a bit, as I say. He wasn't the chap to smile very often. So I said to him, well, I don't understand this. What the hell are you doing here? You know, why have you suddenly turned up? And they said, well, we told their battery commander that he'd got a choice. We wanted to see the war, and he could give us 3 days leave to come up and see the war, or couldn't see it anyway. So I said, by golly, you're a funny old chap. And Bill's standing there as well. We're giggling a bit of this and saying, well, gosh, you can't possibly want to be up here with us, can you? Yes, we're absolutely, you know, dead keen. So I said to Bill, well, find them a spot and dig them in the middle of our perimeter. Three of them together. Not a two-man set, three together. So he takes them off and he found them a spot all right. And it was clear. We hadn't dug in this little spot because it was not there was no foliage around. It was a fairly open spot. It's getting dark now, incidentally. And he said to him, well, it's a bit open, but this is the only place you can put. Oh, they're fantastic. They love this. They can see the corner of the road, and it's absolutely fantastic. And shortly after that, the guns fired a couple of salvos on the road ahead, and oh, they thought that was fantastic. It must be done just for them, and they couldn't wait to get back and tell the gunners that how accurate they'd been. Anyway, we left them there to dig in, and we made a very serious mistake. I made a mistake then, and what I suppose Bill did as well, because we didn't realise that they would dig in and throw all the spoil down the front. Bill came over to me later and said, oh my God, you want to see what they've done? They've dug in all right, but there's must have been all 20 or 30 metres of spoil all spread out down the front there. So there's no doubt at all that there's a trench there. Oh dear. So it wasn't any good telling them because it was, you know, it was done. And we couldn't clear it up in any way. So we knew that no one would be able to see it during the night. It was just if we stayed there the following day, we weren't quite sure what we were going to do about it. Anyway, we said to them, well, look, we won't fit you in the guards because, you know, you're visitors. And they said, no, we insist. We want to do our share of the guards. So I said to Bill, well, put three on together. Take a trip out of ours and put three on together. And, you know, the prowler will keep an eye on them. Anyway, we put them on. I don't know what time it was, 2 o'clock, whatever, 3 o'clock. 10 o'clock perhaps, and when they are actually on during Bill's tourist prowler. Incidentally, I'm doing prowler as well because there's so few of us that, you know, I've got to do prowler as well as hold the radio. So I do prowling whilst Will stays on radio watch because we know the company commander is going to come in a couple of times during the night and check us out, see if we're awake. And about, I don't know what time it was, Bill came, woke me up, or maybe I was awake, I can't remember, and said, they're fast asleep, those New Zealanders, all three of them, fast asleep in the bottom of the trench, and it's their stag. So he said, I've woken them up twice, he said, but they just say, yeah, sorry. But the next minute, they're fast asleep in the bottom of the trench. So I went over and looked at them, and there they were, like three babes, laid in the bottom of the trench, they're fast asleep. So I said, it was. It's a waste of time, this. We'll just close in, you know, just do what we were going to do before and have our normal guard. So we woke up a couple of the others and got them a little bit earlier and we just left them there asleep. And company commander came round just after first light. And funny enough, I had a feeling he was coming. I don't know what made me think it, but I had a feeling he was coming. And I'd gone out literally to meet him. And I said, oh, good morning, sir. Everything okay? He said, yes. And I think he thought he's an old crafty side, so he's got wise to me. But the only trouble I had was the MFC. He was, it was terrible. All the time, all night long, he'd been on at me. What's going on, Corp? What's going on, Corp? And I hate being called Corp at the best of the times, because we never did it in the battalion. And what's going on? Oh, you're not telling me anything. For goodness sake, keep me informed. But I said, I've got nothing to tell you. I mean, he's got a radio. He's got a better radio than I have, actually. He's got a bigger one. I've got a little one, and he's got a big one. But he was a real panicky sort of character. And I remember his name, but I'll not say it. He wasn't Middlesex, as it happens. Anyway, all well. No problems at all. We had a hot breakfast. You know, they got the old boiler going again, and we had a hot Tennessee rations. We're absolutely soaked through to the skin overnight, and as I say, every time you walked out, you got wetter and wetter. But by getting in your sleeping bag fully dressed, well, I mean, it would always be fully dressed, but getting in the sleeping bag sort of dries you off, and by morning, we're just a bit soggy. And the old sleeping bag, you wrap your poncho around your sleeping bag, and it's got sort of semi-waterproof cover. So they've kept reasonably dry in the trenches. We had a fairly good night. I don't know what time, I'd guess 0900, something like that. We went down the road and formed up because we're moving again. We've been told that the brigade had literally formed a box overnight, and we were the forward. We and the Cosby, who had taken over from the Argyles now, were forward, and the Canadians and Australians are to the rear of the box with the guns in the middle. And presumably the American mortars are still with us. And we form up on the road, and we're going to have to march, I don't know, 400 or 500 yards down to the vehicles. I'm standing about there, feeling a little bit forlorn, I must admit. And a very tall brigadier, we never knew the brigadiers, other than Brigadier Code, of course. These new brigadiers are coming and going so fast now that we sort of lost touch who they are. But this guy, in fact, I think his name was Taylor, as it happened, but Burke's gone and Taylor's come in his place. And he's got a jock's hat on his head, tall chap in a raincoat, looking lovely and dry and comfortable. And he walked over and he said to me and the rest of the platoon collectively, "Come on, buck your ideas up. You've only been in the front line 48 hours. And Korea." He thought we were the Cosby. And I'm afraid we totally ignored him. We didn't even look at him, just walk on with our heads down, because what could you say? I mean, how could you think that these ragbags had only just arrived in Korea? I suppose he probably was trying to buck everybody's ideas up. Anyway, he went off to a vehicle, got in the back of it, and again, my little fancy, I got in the back now with my signet, and I left the front open. And of course, naturally, my little fancy second lieutenant comes down, climbs in the front to a lot of muffled mumbles from the lads. Because what he's doing is he's putting his platoon sergeant in his vehicle and coming down and looking after mine. And I know that he's just doing it just to be difficult, because the company commander and Chris Lawrence are treating me very well, you know, as if I'm, you know, a platoon commander. Anyway, off we go. Nothing happens. Very, very quiet ride. Slow but quiet. We come to a slight rise with a stream, the stream in actual fact, that we've been following all this way, is on our left hand side. And as we slowly climb up, the company commander's jeep is just behind us. We're in the lorry ahead. It's all going very, very slow. And there's a tank. American tank is couldn't be parked in a worse place, on the inside. So all the trucks have got to go on the outside of this tank and very, very slowly go by. Anyway, it's a funny looking thing. It's got all sort of tigers' faces all over, painted all over the front. All just, you know, like Chinese tigers, for want of a better word, in yellow and bright colours and things like that. And we start to edge round and we have to stop. And we get talking to the crew, and we said, "What's that on the front of the tank there?" They said, "That's tigers. The Chinese are scared stiff of tigers, so we've painted them all over the front of the tanks there. And when they see them, they'll run like mad." And we think it's a joke. And we laugh, but they're not laughing. I can't believe it. They absolutely believe that when the Chinese see these painted tigers on the front of the tanks, they're going to be running. And I think we've perhaps explained to them fairly carefully that we didn't have too much confidence in their pictures. Anyway, our lorry is just slightly forward of the tank. We're beside it, but slightly forward. And the company commander is standing up in his jeep looking across, and he's spotted loads and loads of fuel. We don't know if it's diesel or what it is, probably petrol. Great loads of it, I don't know, 10 or 12 high. And also, we can see them, some are in the river. Actually, you can see them underneath the water in the river. So he asked the American tank who it was, and he said, "It's left by the 5th Cav. So, well, could you put a shot into it and see if it'll, it'll ignite?" This tank commander's pleased as punch at this. He's probably not fired his gun in action before. So he swings it round, and of course the barrel is running along the back of our truck. So we clamp our hands over our ears because we've been almighty banged when it goes off. And he fired a round into it. And it was the most glorious bonfire you've ever seen in all your life. I can't remember the amount, but it's something like 36,000 gallons or something like that of petrol goes up. I mean, the stuff in the river doesn't go up, of course, but all the stuff that's by this house. It's a wonderful bonfire going up there. We're nearly deafened by this. And the blast comes out the side of the barrel kind of thing, you know. And we slowly move on. But some of the lads leap out the lorry now because there's a feeling that she might go over the side, and the rest of us go over to the tank side and sort of hang over and try and put her weight there. And we slowly got past this tank, and then the convoy opens up again. Throughout the day we go on. We've literally run out of the action now. 5th Cav is ahead of us, and we're now in reserve behind. And we go off to a rest area. A very unusual rest area, this, because I've not seen one before quite like this. But we're a new brigade now, so things are a little bit different. Literally a field with a wire fence around it and a little stream at the end. And I don't know now. It might have had bivouac tents put up there. I can't be sure of this. I've got a feeling the bivouac tents were there, but they're all in lines. And I'd never seen that before, because usually we try and hide ourselves away in the bushes and things like that. But either they were there when we arrived, because I was called away actually to an overgrowth, and the lads had been told to put them up there by the CSM, or maybe they were there, perhaps it was a rest area, a proper rest area. Anyway, Will and I found our tent and we bivvied down for the night and had a good night. I'm not on guard because of platoon commander, and neither is he as a sigma. So he gets his first night's rest since what? I suppose since the 23rd, in actual fact, because, you know, we started off on the 23rd. And we have a good night's rest, jolly good night's rest. But the next morning, there's an O group, as always, you know, and the company commander gives his orders out for the day, and we're to get as much rest as possible. And I'm put, the CSM, a corporal comes over to me in the afternoon and says that the CSM is arranging the guards. Their guards are now under company arrangement, and I'm to be I'm to do a tour during the night for as guard commander. But unfortunately, on the first night that we were there, the company commander's come back, can't find the guard commander because he's wandering about amongst this mass of tents trying to find his guards. And he's ordered that from now on, the guard commander, there's a post been banged in the ground there, and the guard commander isn't to leave this post, whatever he does. Now, there's an unfortunate thing here. First of all, if you do it platoon-wise, do the guards platoon-wise, everybody knows, everybody else knows where they are, what tent they're in, no problem at all about waking people up. Unfortunately, we're running a company guard now, and you haven't got the faintest idea where anybody is. So we go around and we tie bits of string on the top of the people you've got to wake up, and things like that, and stick bits of cardboard on, and it all seemed okay. I've got no complaint about doing a guard. Everybody's taking their turns. Anyway, my turn for guard comes, and they've changed over, and I'm standing by this wretched post, and I suddenly realise that once the sentries have gone off and left you, you've got no control over them at all. None whatsoever. They're supposed to patrol round, come round back to you, and off they go again. But once they're off, they're lost. Just, you can't see them. It's as black as a